Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting a deadly explosion in the eastern Chinese port city of Ningbo. Reuters' Pascal Davies reports.
A big blast in China rocked neighborhoods in the eastern Zhejiang province on Sunday. At least two people were killed, according to officials. Rescuers carried the many injured away from the debris. State news agency Xinhua says the blast happened at a factory in the coastal city Ningbo. Shattered windows were reported in buildings almost a mile away from the site of the explosion, according to Chinese state television. According to the newspaper Zhejiang Daily, several buildings collapsed in a nearby residential area, already cleared of people. Police told Reuters the area had been marked for demolition. The cause is not known, but CCTV said it was not a gas explosion. An investigation is underway.
The death toll in the hundreds, with over 100 injuries, and Egyptian authorities are still responding to Friday's deadly mosque attack in the Sinai Peninsula. Shouting Allahu Akbar, or God is great, militants opened fire in the resulting stampede. Worshippers found the exits blocked with burning vehicles. In the end, 305 people, including 27 children, were gunned down and 128 were injured. A top official in Afghanistan has come under fire for seeming to confirm for the first time that neighboring Iran has recruited thousands of Shiite Afghans and warriors for other regional countries to fight in Syria. Deputy Afghan Chief Executive Mohammad Mahakik made the controversial statement during a trip last week to Tehran. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump sped full throttle Sunday into a special Senate election in Alabama, attacking Democrat Doug Jones as a lawmaker who would be a puppet to party leaders if he is elected next month. In Twitter comments, Mr. Trump did not mention Republican nominee Roy Moore, accused of sexually abusing two teenage girls four decades ago when he was a local prosecutor in his early 30s and pursuing other teen girls for dates. Mr. Trump did say that Jones, a former federal prosecutor, would be beholden to the two top Democratic leaders in Congress, Senator Charles Schumer and Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. The airport on the Indonesian tourist island of Bali remains open Sunday despite the ash from Mount Agung. The volcano has sent plumes of gray smoke and steam thousands of meters into the air. The decision to delay or divert flights is up to individual airlines. Saturday was the second time in less than a week that Mount Agung was active. Australia's latest blueprint for foreign policy says that greater self-reliance is needed as the country prepares for a world in which the U.S. retreats and China becomes more powerful and unpredictable. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Opportunity, security, strength are the three words on the cover of Australia's latest foreign policy document. The white paper is the first since 2003 and sets out Canberra's global strategy for the next decade. Its blunt assessment is that China is challenging America's position as the dominant force in the Asia-Pacific region. The policy blueprint argues the US will remain crucial to Australia's national security, but says Canberra must build even closer ties to Beijing. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull believes Australia must adapt to an evolving world order. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
An artificial earthquake caused by a North Korean nuclear test in September has reportedly caused buildings to collapse and kill scores of people, including school children. That's according to South Korean media reporting this week. On September 3rd, North Korea conducted its sixth nuclear test, successfully detonating a thermonuclear hydrogen bomb, one that could fit into an intercontinental missile. The blast produced two shallow earthquakes where North Korea's nuclear test facility is located. U.S. and Chinese government seismologists reported this at the time, and they say that numerous non-government experts in the United States confirmed that the earthquakes were likely because of the nuclear test. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
But when it comes to actually implementing and walking the talk, that's where we haven't really done what we should have done. And that was to speak out when we see there are human rights abuses in countries, there is abandonment of the rule of law, where there may be rigging of elections.
Botswana President Ian Khama speaks out against leaders who seek more than two full-year terms in office.
We may have made some mistakes, we may have underperformed in some areas. So you have another challenge of scaling up, looking back retroactively, and then see what how much more you need to move in health, in education, in road infrastructure, in so many aspects of development.
The presidential candidate for the Sierra Leonean party outlines his vision for the country.
The vice president really wants to contest 2019, and he thought there are issues with the APC and the president is losing grip. But now with the issues that are coming on, and the president is making some amend to do with the party, with the governors and other leaders, he realized he's going to lose out. If he stays in the party, he may not have an opportunity to contest the 2019.
And the former Nigerian vice president quits the ruling party and rejoins the main opposition People's Democratic Party. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Botswana is highly regarded as a shining example of democracy in Africa. It has enjoyed smooth transition of power from one president to the next since the Southern African country gained independence on September 30, 1966. Many analysts have called on African countries to emulate the Botswana democracy example. The government in Gaborone, led by Seretse Khama Ian Khama, has often lashed out against African leaders who stay in power for decades. This, despite strong opposition from citizens who kick against the removal of term limits, which allows the leaders to seek additional terms in office. In part two of my talk with the leader, President Ian Khama spoke about the role of the Southern African Community, or SADC, and the African Union in entrenching democracy in Africa.
You know, to be honest with you, it's still very much everyone for themselves. We have come up in SADC and with AU very good stated intentions on the issue of democracy. I mean, for that, I give those regional bodies credit for. But when it comes to actually implementing and walking the talk, that's where we haven't really done what we should have done. And that was to speak out when we see there are human rights abuses in countries, there is abandonment of the rule of law, where there may be rigging of elections. Like, you know, even with the issue of the International Criminal Court, when suddenly, you know, I think it was about 35 countries had signed up to the Rome Statute, but then when next leaders are being implicated, suddenly there are all these calls to pull out. So that's where I think, you know, those bodies tend to lose it. And no one really seems prepared to say, look, this is what we signed on for. This is the kind of continent we want to live on. And at the end of the day, we signed on to those things with the express purpose of uplifting the lives of the citizens that we are elected to represent. And when we don't carry out those initiatives we put in place, we're letting ourselves down, we're letting the people we represent down.
Why do you think there's a wave, or there seems to be a trend of African heads of state, because you're an African president, I'm talking to you in the African context, trying to change the constitution? You have a majority in parliament in Botswana. You could have encouraged them to amend the constitution for you to stay in power. You have not done so. Why are your other colleagues doing so, if I may ask you, and what can they learn from the Botswana experience?
I think it's just power hunger. That's the only way to describe it. Because all those countries have many more people than we do in Botswana. They've got populations in well into the millions, many millions. And there must be so many other people who are capable of being good leaders. So why they should think that they're the only ones at that time who can continue is beyond me. But I think it's just driven by power. And like I say, the trappings that come with being in office, that causes them not to want to. So when they come into office, knowing that the Constitution says it's a two-term limit, they think, oh well, 10 years, it's a long time. You know, it won't. You know, it'll I'll be around for quite a long time. But the longer you're in office, the more it then becomes difficult to leave. And like I said, that I suppose to a certain extent that may be human nature. They just become entrenched in what they have, and then they then try and alter their constitutions to allow for a third term or a limitless term. But even that third term is going to end one day, and then what do they do? You know, then they're going to then want another term and go on and on and on until you get to a situation like Mugabe, who probably wanted to end his life in office.
Mr. President, what makes the Botswana democracy experience so unique, and what do you think other African countries can learn from the democracy that Botswana has been practicing for years now?
I think we have entrenched democracy in all our institutions and our way of life. Right from the beginning, from day one, that is what we adopted and we saw it through. And successive leaders have continued to build upon that. And I've tried to do the same here as well. And once you have that kind of system entrenched, it then becomes a way of life for anybody, for everybody. And if you try, if there are any inclinations you're trying to divert from the course, you'll be reminded very quickly that no, this isn't what we want for the country. We want to stay on this course that we set for ourselves. And, you know, we reap the benefits of doing that. I mean, we've got challenges like every other country. But by and large, if you're a democracy and you have good governance, you'll be rewarded in terms of, you know, prudent economic management and foreign investment and economic well-being, despite all the challenges that come to economies around the world. And we know that in other democracies, they've also in recent years had their problems with recessions and everything like that. But if you are people-centered, you are bound to succeed.
Mr. President, I understand you plan on leaving power before your term expires. What is the motivation behind it, and what do you plan on doing after you successfully step down and decide to hand over power smoothly?
I'm leaving before the next election. I'm leaving midterm. Is the truth, and that is because in our constitution you either do two terms or 10 years, and my 10 years is up midterm, so I'll be stepping down early next year. And what motivates me, even if we didn't have, to be quite honest with you, even if we didn't have a two-term limit, I would not have wanted to go on beyond two terms or 10 years, because I think, like I said earlier on, every country has got a wealth of people who could be leaders, and other people should come and others should depart. And I see it like that. I think, you know, people want to see new leaders from time to time, and they don't want to see people there forever.
Seretse Khama Iyankama is the president of the Republic of Botswana. He spoke with me from Habaroni. Sierra Leoneans are scheduled to go to the polls next March to elect new leaders, including a president and parliamentarians. Foreign Minister Samura Matthew Wilson Kamara says he's prepared to become the next leader of the West African country. But opponents say the ruling party, or the All People's Congress, or APC, has failed to meet the aspirations of the people. They say that makes it unlikely for Samura Kamara, the presidential candidate for the ruling APC, to become the next president. They say he is partially to blame for the poor economy. But in part two of my interview with Samura Kamara, he outlined his vision to improve the living conditions of all Sierra Leoneans.
What will be your vision if Sierra Leoneans give you the vote of confidence to lead them as their president?
I think today, at the nomination, yes, for the nomination, I was a flag bearer. But once nominated, I no longer became the flag bearer of the party. is the party that is the flag bearer. And the party has taken Sierra Leone up to a very high level under the leadership of President Nkrumah. And before that, even Dr. Shaker Stevens also did his bit, especially in certain areas. So when President Nkrumah came, it was easy for him to ride on that and then to move the country forward through his agenda for change, the agenda for prosperity. We saw tremendous developments in the area of infrastructure, whether it is road infrastructure, energy, in water. But then, of course, you must also realize that Wumi had made some mistakes. Wumi have underperformed in some areas. So you have another challenge of scaling up, looking back retroactively, and then you see what how much more you need to move in health, in education, in road infrastructure, in so many aspects of development. There are other areas where we attempted, but we are not able, personally I think we've not been able to make serious inroads. And one of them was attitudinal and behavioral change.
When you were appointed by the party, some of your opponents were saying that it appears the president handpicked you. And they said that shows the undemocratic nature, the internal undemocratic nature of the APC party. How do you respond to such criticism?
Well, to tell you the truth, the president went through a long process before he finally made up his mind. The NAC and even all aspirants, we all agree that the president had the capacity, the ability, he had the authority to nominate a candidate, and that everybody would accept that candidate. To the extent that on the eve, we even signed that type of commitment. Every candidate signed. And that was why the number exploded to 28. Prior to that, we're talking about 17, 20. How it came to 28, I don't know. I still cannot lay hands on a list, the list of 28. It's only between the Secretary General of the party and His Excellency the President. They knew the list. But we all signed on to that. And then it was also put to the delegates. At the delegates' convention, they were all asked, what if the president, do you give the president authority? Everybody said, yes, yes, yes. So that was an acknowledgement. So what it meant was that, indirectly, they allowed the president to project his authority. But he had consulted.
Do you think you have the youth vote?
I believe I have the vote of every sector in that society. The youth, the women, the old, the veterans, you named it. I think I do. Because if people say, some people mention it, oh, Samora is not popular, it's not known. My interpretation to that is that the number of years I've spent in managing Sierra Leone's economy, in establishing most of these institutions that you see today in Sierra Leone, including the SLBC, you know, the transformation, National Revenue Authority, National Social Security Institute, the institution, NASIT, the procurement, you know, all the what I call the governance reforms, institutional reforms that have taken place, and up to the preparation of the agenda for change and the agenda for prosperity. If only you have been following those, you would have asked yourself, who is behind all of this? And then you would have known it's Samora Kamara.
Samora Kamara is the Sierra Leonean foreign minister. He spoke with me from here in Washington. The Nigerian former Vice President Atiku Abubakar has resigned from the ruling All Progressives Congress, or APC. He has since rejoined the main opposition party, People's Democratic Party, or PDP. Local media reports that the former vice president might have left the ruling party in order to challenge incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari. Critics say Atiku Abubakar appears to be too desperate to leave the country, which they say is why he decided to often change political parties. For analysis, I reached Dr. Siddiq Umar Gombe, a Nigerian activist and political commentator in the capital, Abuja.
In reality, the former Vice President Atiku Abubakar has the right to leave any party, but nonetheless, for anybody that is following his antecedent in politics, knew that he has been up and on into this party, to the other, from the PDP to the AC to the ACN, back to beat APC, and now maybe probably he's eyeing going back to his former political party, wherever he's thinking he's going to get the ticket of the party to contest 2019 presidential election. Though nonetheless, really there are issues in APC, but to me, fighting internal democracy as a reason for somebody to leave APC, there wasn't any Congress, either in his state or convention at the national level, where he was denied any opportunity to participate, given a level playing ground. And I was made to understand the APC leadership said there is no automatic ticket for any member of the APC, the fact that they have an incumbent president.
Critics of the former vice president are saying that he is too desperate to become Nigeria's next president, and that is the motivation behind his decision to yet again move from another party, because this is not the first time, as you enumerated in your initial submission. What do you make of this criticism?
Yes. Well, in reality, there are some iota of truth to that, but in essence, one cannot say there are no issues with the ruling party. Really, the ruling party have issues. That was why the vice president, being a very intelligent politician, make reference to the letter written to the president by a governor who is a very close associate of the president, that is the governor of Kaduna State. If you can see through all the items itemized by the vice president as the reason, he cited the letter very importantly, cutting El Rufai from what he said about the party, about lack of internal democracy, lack of carrying party members alone in decision-making. But that is one of the issues to do with democracy. If you are securing a ticket of a party, that means you are a party man. But as long as you are elected as a leader of a nation that have about 50-something political parties at present, and diverse interests, there is no way you can stick to only your party, because you want to appease all aspects and all others. So I want to say, probably, the vice president really wants to contest 2019, and he thought there are issues with the APC and the president is losing grip. But now with the issues that are coming on, and the president is making some amend to do with the party, with the governors and other leaders, he realized he's going to lose out. If he stays in the party, he may not have an opportunity to contest the 2019, or he may not have a level playing ground that he can contest along with the incumbent. And the incumbent, the fact that he didn't say he wants to contest, but all issues are towards the direction that the incumbent president wants to run for 2019, or people are calling on him to run 2019. And the former vice president doesn't have any chance in that regard.
Yes. Governor El Rufai went to Aso Rock on Friday. Some see it as a sign of support or a strong bond, as a measure to unite the party and to show support for both the ruling APC as well as President Muhammadu Buhari. What do you make of this assessment?
I think, you see, politics is a game of interest. There is no permanent friend, no permanent enemy. El Rufai initially is also ambitious, also thinking that the president may not contest, and we push him through to succeed him. But when he realizes the president recuperated and the president is gaining ground, even in the southeast, so now, and also El Rufai is facing serious challenges in Kaduna. He is one of the governors that many Nigerians believe he's not going to make it to have a second term because of most of his anti-people policies in Kaduna. So he has no alternative rather than to reverse to his former boss, whom he rode through to become a governor in Kaduna. So that's why he's not championing. And for that reason, also his letter to the president, which angered the president and some loyal party members, they see it as a betrayal. So he has to do more to prove himself that he is really with the president and with the party, so that he can secure the party ticket, at the same time secure the support base of the president in Kaduna to also attain his ambition of having a second term.
Dr. Siddiq Umar Gombe is a Nigerian activist and political commentator. He spoke with me from Abuja. A group from the Cameroonian English-speaking region say they have established an interim government. It is led by Sisiku Ayuktabi, who escaped to neighboring Nigeria, fearing arrest from the government in Yaoundé.
The self-described interim government of Ambazonia says the administration in Yaoundé has failed to resolve the Anglophone crisis and has rather resorted to violence to suppress dissent. Supporters of the government rejected the accusations and want the group's leaders tried for treason and for attempting to break up the country. To learn more, I reach Christopher Anu, spokesperson for the so-called Ambazonia interim government.
The formation of the interim Ambazonia government became necessary following our declaration of statehood or the restoration of statehood on October 1. We felt that until then, we have been called the governing council. And so we felt that having restored our statehood, we needed a government that can pass instructions to our people, a government that can speak directly to our people. Not La République du Cameroun, as has been the case.
The constitution frowns on such groups as yours. You have formed an interim government. It sharply goes against the Cameroonian constitution. Some people are saying that it's treasonous. Members of the government should be arrested and prosecuted for treason. Your reaction to that?
That is a very big error they are making. We are the people of Ambazonia or the Southern Cameroons are a group of people that, like any other group of people, that need to that have the right for self-determination. And so what we have done is just turn to that right for self-determination to declare or restore our sovereignty. We have never been part of the Republic of Cameroon. We were a sovereign state when we joined out of the Republic of Cameroon, and it was meant to be so. It was two states coming together. One did not assimilate the other. And so when we found out that we are being assimilated, we have said no. We are taking back our nation. We are going back to what it was supposed to be. That is what we have just done. And so we are not bound by the constitution of La République du Cameroun.
Some people are saying you are trying to rewrite history because English-speaking part of Cameroon has been part of Cameroon. The government says you are secessionists using violence to achieve your aim of destabilizing the country and creating disaffection in the country.
We are not secessionists, sir, if they understand what a secessionist is. We join La République du Cameroon as a sovereign state. And when they say we are using violence to try to secede, we are not seceding. And who is using violence? It is the Republic of Cameroon that is using violence. In Boya, we have mass graves. We are still asking the Republic of Cameroon, why can't they order the exhumation of that grave? And let's see what happened there. Who is the United Nations blaming and calling to stop violence? It's not the Ambazonians. It's the Republic of Cameroon.
The government says it is ready for dialogue.
If they are ready for dialogue, this struggle has been on more than 12 months, and they have not for once called us to the table. Where is that dialogue? There are those amongst us who are talking about federation. You would think that those are the people that they should be talking with. They have not even reached out to them. So they are not talking dialogue. They are propagating.
Who elected you to lead them, by the way? There was no
election. The people of Ambazonia elected us to lead this struggle, sir.
How did they elect you in exile?
We were not elected just in exile. They reached a unanimous agreement between Ambazonians both home and abroad who have said we need our own government from whom we will take instructions.
But I have also heard different groups claiming they don't recognize this Sinsiku-led Ambazonia faction and that they are fake and that they don't represent the English-speaking people of Cameroon. So there's division, there's no unanimity. So whom do you speak for as an interim government that you have set up?
Those groups you are referring to, they are minority groups, sir. If you look at apartheid in South Africa, you have the Chief Buthelezis who were against Mandela, fighting against apartheid, yet they also were looking for independence or some kind of rights. And so in every movement, you have those type of people. The fact is that the majority of Ambazonians, Southern Cameroonians, are behind this interim government. And you are going to see in the course of time that they are all behind it by virtue of the support that we are getting.
Christopher Anu is the spokesperson for the so-called interim government of Ambazonia in Cameroon. He spoke with me from Houston in the U.S. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
With the best man, and I've been so lonely in my life, but now I can hold on tonight. Cause I decide. Come out to chinny, come out to your chinny, come out to chinny, come out to your chinny, come out to chinny, come out to your chinny, come out to chinny, come out to your chinny. Come out to chinny, come out to your chinny, come out to chinny, come out to your chinny, come out to chinny, come out to your chinny, come out, come out, come out, come out, come out.
I I'm gonna call you Coco. I'm gonna be your Lolo. Wanifanya niwe kama popo. So many times that I want you, baby, baby, yo. Bring me some new love. Take me to the top. So many times that I want you. 'Cause I've been so lonely in my life, but now I can hold on tonight. 'Cause I decide, 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 decide. 'Cause I decide, 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 decide.
Come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini. Don't you say that I would deny, get you down to my soldier. To me, I wanna see you whine. Let us get to that corner.
Don't you see I would not deny. Let me hold your shoulder. I'm gonna really whine and take it slow. 'Cause I'm falling in love.
Come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini.
'Cause I'm falling in love.
Come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini.
'Cause I'm falling in love.
Come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini.
'Cause I'm falling in love.
Come out to chini. Come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come.
Chega casa de manhã, Boboca estava lá, me sei pra procurar. Me te chamou na telefone, ma boca tá atendendo. Desespero tomar na me. Depois de tudo que não passa, hoje busta bem fazer si. A mim que está entendendo. Boca tem razão de pai, boca sabe modi quem está. Modi quem está gente dentro de mim. É dor demais, é um dor demais. Que me está gente dentro de mim. É dor demais, é um dor demais. Que me está gente dentro de mim. Boquita completa, abunha mundo, nhama jamia, paras de mim. Minta pediu que abu deixar, minha baby volta, volta pra casa, volta pra mim. Depois de tudo que não passa, hoje busta bem fazem si, a mim que está entender. Boca tem razão de pai, boca sabe modi quem está. Modi quem está gente dentro de mim. É dor demais, é um dor demais. Que me está gente dentro de mim. É dor demais, é um dor demais. Que me está gente dentro de mim. Oh,
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It is quite understandable that Africans, African governments, and African institutions are all outraged by footages contained in a CNN video showing black Africans being traded literally as slaves in Libya. The International Organization of Migration also said it had collected evidence to show that slavery is being practiced in Libya. Years ago, we heard of stories of the practice of slavery in Mauritania, although that government had denied that such practice existed. One government has been so outraged by the CNN video that it had asked the Organization of African Unity, AU, to cooperate with it despite its limited resources. That is Rwanda, which had undergone in its own history a terrible genocide. It is important to note that France called for the Security Council to meet, and the Council has met, and an investigation has been authorized. But this should not be the end of the story. It is necessary that the African Union called Libya into account for this outrageous action taking place in Libya. Nevertheless, we should also bear in mind the train of events that is now producing this dastardly act in Libya. All may recall that the African Union in 2011 produced a well-thought-out roadmap to solve the Libyan problem. But those who were only interested in regime change rejected that African plan. And as we know, as a result of a NATO-led action in Libya, Colonel Gaddafi was killed in October 2012. The repercussion has been felt mainly in Africa. First, it was the revolution that we have seen in many parts of North Africa because of the flow of arms. Now we have a situation where the European Union, through Italy, has been negotiating with elements in Libya to have detention camps. And one African had said those detention camps are like living in hell. And it is that practice of detention camps to prevent migration into Europe that has brought about this act of slavery. So in the investigation that the Security Council is calling for, one must not only look at the act of trading of Africans, but also the entire flow of events that led to this unfortunate act. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter and producer Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the man who has bread to eat does not appreciate the severity of a famine. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Tunisia have a strong partnership that is based upon mutual interests and shared values. The bilateral relationship with Tunisia extends more than 200 years, when Tunisia became one of the first countries in the world to recognize the newly formed United States. Similarly, in 1956, following Tunisia's independence, the United States was the first major power to recognize Tunisian sovereignty and establish diplomatic relations. Since that time, said Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan, our partnership has continued to grow, thanks to the efforts of the Tunisian citizens who in 2011 took courageous steps to embrace democracy, human rights, and freedom as a means to achieve equality and social dignity. The United States is proud to support Tunisia's efforts to improve security, develop democratic institutions and practices, and foster economic growth. In 2017, the United States increased its development and military assistance to Tunisia by more than 30% over 2016 levels to $205.4 million. Deputy Secretary Sullivan and his Tunisian counterparts discussed the critical economic reforms and anti-corruption measures the Tunisian government is working to put into action. These reforms will bring about increased economic growth and prosperity, trade relations, foreign investment in Tunisia, and access to markets for Tunisian products. The U.S. supports Tunisia's continued efforts to encourage inclusive economic growth and improve its business climate. Discussions also focused on the importance of mutual security. We must consolidate gains against ISIS and deny safe havens to those terrorist groups who continue to probe for opportunities to regroup in North Africa and threaten the United States and our partners, including Tunisia. The recent terrorist attacks that occurred both here in Tunisia and in New York underscore the importance of our continued collaboration to ensure mutual security, which is more critical now than ever before, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. The United States looks forward to a growing relationship with Tunisia based on economic growth, security, and shared democratic values.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.